So, this evening, I would like to talk about three qualities which are considered important to cultivate when we meditate on the spiritual path. Can everybody hear me? It's okay? If anyone cannot really hear me, you can always come closer. And these three qualities are great faith, great courage, and great inquiry. And great faith. Like that? Actually, just take your chair. Just take your chair. Come here. You'll be more comfortable. So, great faith, it's faith in our potential. Great courage will give us energy, enthusiasm. And great inquiry will help us to develop clarity and compassion. So, great faith, what is interesting with great faith, it actually brings us a bit to motivation. We sit here, we're going to do this retreat, you're going to sit in meditation, you're going to walk. And at times you might wonder, what am I doing here? Why did I come here? And it's interesting, our motivations. You know, we want to do meditation, maybe to relax, or maybe because somebody do it and it seems to be good for them, or I read in a book, or... Nowadays, you have all these advertisements with people sitting in meditation, sailing, all kind of things. So it's really around. So there is all kind of motivation for doing it. And if I look at my motivation, I started to meditate or to be interested in meditation when I was 18. Because when I was 18, I realized that I could not do with my mind what I wanted. I was very idealistic. I wanted to love everybody. And I could see jealousy, anger, and I thought, you want to be this wonderful person, and then you have all these nasty things in your mind. And I could not just say to myself, stop. It did not work whatsoever. So I thought, maybe I'll try to find a method by which I can do something with this state of mind, with these emotional states. Because I could see that I had outside freedom, but I did not feel I had inside freedom. So that's why I wanted to come to work, to do meditation. And so this is a little the reason I did meditation. Then I became a nun. And this was very happenstance. I ended up in Korea because of a mistake in a plane ticket. And I got there. And then there was this woman who said to me, why don't you become a nun? If I was you, I would become a nun. I thought, that's not a bad idea. And I said, I learned calligraphy. Maybe I learned Tai Chi. And I learned meditation. I never learned calligraphy, I never learned Tai Chi, but I learned meditation. And what was interesting was that over time, actually my motivation changed. At the beginning, I was doing meditation for certain reasons. And as I did meditation, over time I realized I was just doing it for its own sake. I was doing it because it was like food for the organism, that actually it was feeding my being, it was feeding my spirit. And so I think we have to be careful when we come to meditation, especially if we expect special mystical state. And then you sit in meditation and you spend most of your time waiting for something special to happen. So you're kind of like this. waiting for something to happen. And personally, I think it's not like that at all. It's just a cultivation of something. The cultivation of concentration, the cultivation of experiential inquiry, which then has a certain effect, is actually food for the organism. So for me, I would say meditation nowadays, it's very much like brushing my teeth. I brush my teeth, and I presume you brush your teeth too, every day, possibly once, twice, or three times a day. And when you brush your teeth, you don't suddenly go, wow, this was such an amazing brushing of teeth. I must tell all my friends about it. And, you know, create a school around this brushing of teeth. You just do it because this is a thing that helps you help you to feel cleaner in the mouth. And I think meditation in the same way. We just do it to feed ourselves, to feed our being, to feed our organism. So I would say that actually an act of meditation is an act of faith. Faith in ourselves, faith in our potential to develop and to manifest wisdom and compassion, to actually really develop this creative potential which is within us, that we can develop, uncover, manifest. That's what for me meditation is. But at the beginning, we feel separate from really the meditation. I think faith at the beginning is more like belief. Oh, meditation should be good for me. I need to do this. And you might, during this retreat, maybe at times feel, this is not fun, but still, I must do it. You know, this is good for me. In the end, it is good for me. So in a way, at the beginning, we're a little separate from the faith. But I think over time, as we meditate more and more, then we actually have what I would call experience the meditation within ourselves. And then we start to see that actually it works, that actually there is a releasing, there is a de-grasping. And then we become one with the faith. For myself, one of the time when I saw this clearly was I was doing a 3-month retreat like you do in Korea if you are a nun or a monk. So you sit 10 hours a day, 50 minutes, 5-0, and you walk 10 minutes a day. And you do this all day long. And so I was doing that. And like you, I had a job to do. And at 4 o'clock every afternoon, I had to clean the bathroom. And it was a communal bathroom. And every day, 4 o'clock, there was a nun there. And she washed herself. And she was in the way. So every day I was upset. 4 o'clock, she is here. So the first time I said, oh, please, could not you come at another time? She said, no, I am going to do chanting. I need to be pure. So I could not say anything about that. She had priority. Her purity had priority. So every day, 4 o'clock, I would just meditate all day long. And in Korea, we ask the question, what is this? Which I'll bring later on in the week. So all day long it would be, what is this? What is this? Just meditating and not thinking about the bathroom. 4 o'clock, contact. She's still there. Oh, really, she's in the way. Oh, really, you know. And the whole time I would work, I would be kind of resentful. And it went like this for 2 weeks. Contact, upset. And after 2 weeks, one day I go down to the bathroom, 4 o'clock, she is there, I am there, and it's totally fine. There is no grasping, there is nothing. There is just the doing of it. And what was interesting for me that I had not told myself, you must not be like this, you must not be upset. I had not done any of that. I just meditated. And so to me, I saw that one of the main things about the meditation is to release the grasping, the holding. And that's what I experienced that day. And that gave me confidence confidence in myself that I could ungrasp, confidence in the practice that it was working. So I would say over time, we become one with the faith, that actually the faith is really within us. And then the faith, the great faith is important to really, in a way, kind of be the ground of the practice. Because sometimes it's easy. My teacher, Master Kuzan, a Korean master, used to say, sometimes the meditation, it's so easy. It's like pushing a boat on ice. It just goes. No effort. And at other times, it's so difficult. It feels like you are dragging a cow to drink who doesn't want to move. And very little is shifting. And for this reason, in a way, we need the great faith. It will be watered when things are difficult. And it will help us when things are difficult. It will be like, even though it's difficult, I have faith in myself. I have faith in the practice. I can go through it. And I think it's a little like the sun behind the clouds. Now, at the moment, the sun is very evident. And from what I understand, you won't have any rain until November, which is kind of like, for me, kind of strange things. So, I mean, the sun is going to be very evident for you. But for us, I mean, often we have lots of clouds and storm, and then the sky is black. The sky is black, and it rains. And on our side, it's really stormy. But on the side of the sun, behind the cloud, the sun stays there. And the great faith is the same. It's always with us, that great faith in our potential, in our experience, in the practice. And then there is great courage. And great courage will give energy, will activate, will give us, there is activity, there is movement, there is perseverance. So in a way, we have to act out of the faith. We can't just have faith and wait for, in a way, the practice to fall upon us from somewhere. We have to do something. We have to move. Often we think of meditation as relaxing. And actually, you might find that meditation is not so relaxing, but that it actually is hard work. You know, you have to sit there 45 minutes trying to be present, holding the body. So actually, I would say each time you sit in meditation, each time you walk in meditation, you are cultivating great courage. And great courage, there are different types of courage. For example, some of you might possibly at times have a little difficulty with the silence during this week. But some years ago when I was doing some research about women and Buddhism, I went back to Korea and I went to this nunnery, and there was one nun who looked really impressive. We were just peeling potatoes, very ordinary, but she looked like really there, like she had really amazing presence. So I wondered, and I asked about her, and I was told, oh, she just finished a 10-year retreat in silence. So, you see, you have only a week. And she did it not because anybody told her to do it, but because she had the great faith and she had the great courage, and that's what she wanted to do. Or if I think of my teacher, Master Kuzan, he had a difficulty when sitting in meditation. He would sit in meditation and then he would fall asleep. So then for a while he had a knife under his chin. And then he started to fall asleep sideways. So finally, he decided for 2 weeks he would really practice hard. And then he stood on his tiptoe holding his hand like this for 2 weeks. I mean, you know, 50 minutes at a time. And he said the first hour was a little painful, but after that, it was okay. But nobody obliged him to do this. He just did it because at that moment, he had the great faith, he had the great courage. And so for us, what is a great courage? I mean, I don't think we need to be in silence for 10 years, or I don't think you need to be on your tiptoe for 2 weeks. But I think for us, The great courage is to go beyond our limits, to go actually beyond our habits. Because I think that's what you will find when you sit in meditation, when you are on retreat. What is it that blocks you? What is it that limits you? And actually what you see is actually your mental, emotional, and physical habits. That's what generally kind of limits us. That's what generally what stops us. And so in a way, I feel the great courage we need here on this retreat is to really try to go a little beyond our habits. For example, mental habits. You sit in meditation, and I would say one of the thing that most people do when they sit in meditation, especially at the beginning, but even later on sometime, is daydreaming. It's one of the favorite activity when you meditate. The time passes so nicely when you do daydreaming. It really is wonderful. And I ring the bell and you think, already, you know? But because you're not here whatsoever, you are, and it's very interesting to see how it starts. You're sitting in meditation, okay, the breath, and then suddenly the thought. If I had, if I won the lottery, or if I get this job, or if I don't know, whatever is your dream. And then you go into this beautiful daydream. Everything goes according to plan. It's like a film where you do everything. From acting to producing to screenwriting, you even sell the peanuts. So it's wonderful. And what is it? It's a mono reality. So everything goes according to plan. And if you do this in daily life, actually it can lead to great frustration. Because generally what happens in daily life, which is a multi-complex reality, things often don't go according to our screenwriting, we kind of our plan, it doesn't work out. So in a way to see, we're sitting in meditation, we're watching the breath and see the feel, the thought, it's so seductive. If I had, if I was, and having the great courage to come back. So you don't, not judging the daydreaming, but you see it for what it is. This is not meditating, this is going somewhere else. So coming back to the breath. Just that. That's a great courage. Not to be seduced by those thoughts. And just come back to this moment. To the potential for life in this moment. Another something we can notice sometime in terms of emotional habits. When we sit in meditation, one relatively common is boredom. You sit in meditation and nothing happens. And we have a strong association between nothing happening with boredom. So I sit and you think, oh, it's so boring. The breath, the breath again. Oh, it's so. But actually, you see, what is boredom? What is boredom? What is nothing happening? At least nothing bad is happening. It's already something. Nothing tremendous is happening either, but it's actually very peaceful. It's actually very restful. So trying to, instead of moving into this, it's so boring. It's like my niece. I have a niece, and she's 10 years old. And 2 years ago, she went through this time of, she had crisis of boredom. She would go, I am bored! And she would cry and shout, and I had to do something about it. And in a way, boredom. It's just nothing is happening. It can be so peaceful to really see this time here that actually we rest. But we rest in an open way. Because to me, what is interesting, when we watch the breath, what are we focusing on? We're focusing on our life. That, as my teacher used to say, your life depends upon a single breath. If you have the next breath, you're still there. If no breath anymore, finished. So in a way, our life rests upon a single breath. So in a way, by being focused on the breath, aware of the breath, we can be aware of our life. And to me, when we think of evolution, you think of evolution, million years of evolution. You know, when you had the little thing which kind of went off out of the water, and then down the line you had the human coming up. And so you have these million years of evolution which end up in me or you, and you sit there after this million year of evolution, so that you are there and you say, this is so boring. I mean, poor evolution, all this work for nothing. So in a way, trying to see, just to be present, in a way, through the breath to life itself, to its potential in any moment. Then you also have physical habits. And physical habit, I think, one of the strong ones we have, especially in this modern world, is comfort. I'm reading a book at the moment of a friend of ours who does meditation, and I'm realizing reading his book is that he's a shepherd, but he's a kind of fairly extreme shepherd, and he just loves to sleep on the ground. For me, just sleeping on the ground is unthinkable. I think sciatica if I sleep on the ground. But there is a medium between his position and maybe our position, where actually we so use to have things which are easier for ourselves. That actually, that's why I think sometimes meditation on retreat is difficult, because you sit, you walk, and the body is a little difficult, you know, tiring, a little difficult for the body. But to see, to try to tomorrow I'll talk more about this, but going inside the discomfort. And in a way, to see is just sensation moving, shifting. And to me, this was a great revelation. When I went to Korea, and I became a nun, and I started this retreat, 3 months, 10 hours a day, getting up 3 o'clock in the morning, going to bed 9 o'clock at night, and I never sat before, just 10 minutes here and there. And I had to sit 50 minutes, 5-0, it's really very painful. So I would sit in meditation and I could not breathe, and it was so painful and it was terrible. So I just came to the first sit and I missed the next two, came to the next first sit of the next session. And I did that's the way, because I used to think, it's so bad, maybe I'm better to do something useful, learn Korean or clean the bathroom or do something useful at least. This is really too difficult. And then after 2 weeks of this, a master came to sit with us. So then I really sat well. He's there, I must make an effort. Yes, yes, the body, the mind, yes, yes, yes. But after 50 minutes, I was exhausted. So I thought, he can stay, I am off, I'm off. So I went off, and he saw it. And he, ooh. So when I came back, the leader of the hall had the dictionary in hand to say, master said, and I always remembered it. He said, Okchiro Chamta, you must bear beyond strength. So in a way, he was saying, you must go beyond your physical comfort. And then I thought, it is true. They've been doing this for 800 years and nobody died of it. So maybe I can make an effort. And what was interesting is that really this made the difference, I would say, to my practice. Because I started to do the whole schedule. I did not miss anything anymore. I started to arrive the first one. And it was still a little difficult, but it was, I just did it. And I think that's where finally I had the great courage with the great faith. And I was just sitting there. Sometimes it was fine, sometimes not, but I was prepared to sit there. And so in a way, to see, of course, if it's too painful, sit on a chair, or if really it's too bad, you can go and lie down in your room. But if you can, time to time, trying to go beyond slightly our comfort zone. So the great courage will give us the energy, the power to practice. And then there is great inquiry, great experiential inquiry, and to see that the great faith and the great inquiry goes together. So the faith is the ground, but then you need the inquiry to open things up, so that it's not just does not become stale. And so it's an active quality of the practice, what I would call a creative quality of the practice. And it is really looking deeply into the experience. And so we'll talk about this again and again during the retreat, to really go inside the experience, to be more present to the experience, to really kind of be as close as we can to it as it happened, instead of what we think about it or our comments upon it, but really going as close as we can to the experience, because that is what will have the power to make us see, to transform, and also to give us choices. To me, this is a very important part of our practice. So we look deeply into the perception, deeply into our story, and also deeply into our misperception. Often we have suffering in our life because of this misperception. And so what the Buddha was telling us in terms of looking deeply is to look at the three characteristics of impermanence, unreliability, and non-self. And to me, what is important about this looking deeply into this is that actually this is the ground of compassion. Because it seems a little negative. Impermanence, unreliability, non-self, it looks like a little dry and negative. But I would say when we really know it, we really experience it, then out of that, compassion for ourselves and others arise. So I would like to look at this a little. The first one is to, in the experience, to, in a way, know the changing nature, that we kind of feel the changing nature. And why is that? Because we have a tendency to not really see it that way. But first, what is, you have change, and you have two aspects to change. One is ultimate change, and that is death. And often we live our life, and I feel we take things for granted. I used to live in a community, long ago in a community, and the big thing we spend our time talking about, nearly once a week, was that some people did not wash the teacups. And we generally would spend at least half an hour or an hour about this washing of teacups, like it was this amazing, important thing. And I used to think, but you know, our life rests upon a single breath. It would be faster to wash the teacup, whoever is there in the kitchen that day, instead of spending 30 minutes about you must do it. And in a way, often we kind of see impermanence nearly as this fatalism. So to be careful with that. When I was first in a nun, things would get broken, like a vase would fall and get broken. I would say, "Ah, it's impermanent." You know, it's not, especially if it's not mine. Who cares? You know, it's impermanent. But that's not what really impermanence is about. Personally, I really understood impermanence when I saw my father die. I saw his last breath. I was there in that moment, and at that moment, I really experienced impermanence. And what was interesting is that at that moment arose this great compassion, because at that moment I realized my life, everybody's life, rests upon a single breath. And I realized how precious life was, mine, others, and I started to look at them beyond the image I had of them, and to really reach out to the human being who is alive. And so I would say when we really know impermanence, naturally compassion arises for that life which is so fleeting. But there is another aspect of impermanence, change, which is actually the fact that things can change. And we often we lead our life as if things won't change. This is one of the things we say often is, you always do this. meaning, you know, you will always do that way. I remember when I first learned to drive quite late, after I left the monastery, and it was a little stressful to drive. And often I would leave the key in the car. In those days you could do that, and then lock the key in the car. Then I would phone Stephen, the key are in the car, can you come with us? I do it once, I do it twice, I do it a third time, and he said, you always lock the key in the car. So I had this vision that day in, day out, forever after I was going to do this. And I thought, you know, we'll go for divorce, you know. And I thought, wait a minute, I don't always do it. I do it time to time. Then I looked at the condition in which I would do it. And I realized it was when I had to park in a tight space. So after that, I parked in a tight space. I went for the key first, and then I got out, and then he started to do it too. So in a way, I think if you really know change, if we really know change, we know that there is a potential for change in myself and in others. And to me, this is a gift of impermanence. And to me, this is a gift of compassion. That when you are with yourself or in front of somebody else, they might not change immediately, but there is a potential for them to change at some point. And that's in a way we give them a chance. Because we cannot do anything every... When you say always, you're saying every second, every minute, every hour, every day. You can't sustain anything like that. Long ago, when my nephew had lots of problems, he came to live with us, and he could not find work, and he was really kind of, it was very painful for him. And I thought, what can I do? The only thing I can do is to teach him a little meditation, just in case, you know, why not? I was around at the time, so I taught him just a breath meditation. He did not do much with it at the time. And then 20 years later, I am talking to him at one of these family reunions. He said, you know, a few years back, I was in Paris. I had such a hard time at work, and I was so stressed. And then I did your breath meditation. It was so useful. And it showed me that in a way we can plant seeds, and then they will flower when they can flower. So in a way to really know change, will help us to be in our life in a different way, toward ourselves, toward others, I would say, with a more compassionate, with a more open attitude. And then you have unreliability. And so in a way, the Buddha says things are unreliable because they change. I mean, it's fairly obvious, but it's interesting. Especially with this modern life, we don't like things to be too unpredictable. Or we like a bit of unpredictability for fun, but not too much. And often, look at yourself when you sit in meditation. A lot of the time, you will be doing planning. And what is planning? It's generally control. You know, you're preparing yourself so you're not surprised. And however much you prepare, often we are surprised. I remember many years ago, I was invited to Sweden. It was the first time they were getting me. They did not know about me. They were a little concerned, but still, I must do this, I must do that. So I'd never been so prepared to go somewhere. So I get my ticket, I get the insurance for my ticket, everything. And then the day before I am going, I pass in front of the TV of my mother, and there is a news, and I sit down, and I learned that the company has gone bankrupt. So my first reaction is, oh, well, it's impermanent. And then I thought, well, compassionately, I must go there. So I found another ticket. But again, it's, you know, things are unpredictable. And it's kind of learning to just be with that unpredictability so that we can creatively engage with it. Then unsatisfactoriness, which is part of this dukkha, is actually not saying that there cannot be any satisfaction in life, not at all. But we cannot have lasting satisfaction. And that's generally what we hope for, to have something which will give us lasting happiness. That it be a job, that it be a partner, that it be a house, that it be whatever it is. We have the feeling, if I get this, then I am going to be happy ever after. It's interesting. We have this kind of, again, this permanentizing. I remember my first book. I was every morning, I was waiting for that book, like, oh, this is going to give me such a fantastic happiness, you know, and I was waiting, and finally it comes, breakfast. I open it, I look the front, I look the back, it lasted about 5 seconds. And then I still had to eat my bread and still go to work, and did not change my life. So in a way, to see is more the problem. Of course we can appreciate good things, but to see what we kind of add to it, which then can bring suffering. And then the last one, aspect of dukkha, the second characteristic, is suffering. And to me, from suffering, what we can learn by knowing suffering, not forcing suffering, but knowing suffering, is two things. That suffering is painful, and we are alone in that pain. Nobody can experience our pain for us. And when we realize that suffering makes us alone and it's painful, we cannot but have compassion for our own suffering and the suffering of others. And to me, this is where the understanding suffering really comes from. I remember when I was in Korea, I became ill with the stomach very quickly. And so for a few months I was, oh, poor me, I'm suffering. And what was interesting was my first thought, why me? When you say that, you say, why is it not happening to somebody else? It's not very compassionate, is it? And then I thought, but this is the suffering the Buddha is talking about, you know, that I have to deal with. And then I could look at the condition, why it happened. And it happened on certain day when I ate too much because there was too many variety and I was a little too curious. So I learned from that. So now we're kind of seeing what goes on, and also that compassion for ourselves and others. And the last one, Stephen will talk more about this, but it's one which is a little tricky, because this is the one which says that there is no self. But the fact that the Buddha says to look into no self doesn't mean that we are looking for nothing. This is very important. No self is not about the void with a huge V. And it doesn't mean that everybody at some point is going to disappear into the void and then we'll have just puff of smokes on the cushions. This is not no self. No self is just saying there is no self which is kind of fixed, solid, independent of everything else. So basically it's just saying we are conditioned. And to me, this is what the meditation is about. It's actually discovering more and more the inner condition that form us, and also our meeting the outer condition. So that over time, we realize we are this flow of condition. But it doesn't mean that I'm going to, with impermanence and no self, often there is this idea that there is constant change. That's not so. There is a certain change, but it has its own speed. Like myself, tomorrow, it's very unlikely that instead of me, there will be a giraffe sitting on this chair. That's, I don't think there will be such a change in my life overnight. But, I mean, I could, you know, have a heart attack. That's in the realm of the possibility. So in a way, there is something which remains relatively constant according to how the flow of condition goes. If the flow of condition, which is made of the physical, the emotional, the mental, meeting the outer condition, continue in its way, then I'll be here tomorrow morning. If something happened to one of these conditions, we'll see. I hope I will be here tomorrow. So in a way, what the Buddha is trying to make us see is that we're not as solid and fixed as often we feel ourselves to it. But often this is that, the feeling we have, that we fixed, we solid, and then onto it, things stuck to it. You see, it's like we feel here, there is this kind of little cube called Marty. And then whatever happens to me goes and tick, stick onto the cube, a little like a pin cushion. And then time to time I remember, ooh, that one was a painful one, you know, a little blood. But there is nothing here to which nothing can stick to. So this is what the Buddha is saying. He's more saying that we are more fluid, that we are more like processual. And so to realize the condition that forms us. And actually this, to me, leads again to compassion. Because if you experience yourself in this moment, who are you? What is it that constitutes you? Your survival depends on outside. The air you breathe, the food you eat, the water you drink, the clothes you wear, the house you live in. Generally, it comes from energy from the outside. So our whole life rests upon outside. So we're not fixed and solid and independent. One way to experience it a little, this flow of condition, this kind of little, kind of this openness, this spaciousness, I would call, is when we do the breath, so we rest our attention on the breath, and then we look into the air that we breathe. Ask yourself, in the experience, not scientifically, but in the experience, what is this air that I breathe? And if you look into the air that you breathe, in the experience, you realize that all of us, we're breathing the same air. So your air go into my lung, my air go into your lung, and then it gets stale, of course. It gets a little muggy. But it shows that there is no separation. Through the pores of my skin, through my nose, my mouth, the air, the world coming to me, I go back into the world. So in a way, this idea of conditionality, of non-self, is actually to see how our life is so interdependent with the rest of life. And so again, it helps us to open ourselves up. Instead of being this thing which I have to protect against all the bad things out there, you actually see that your life is totally conditioned, totally meshing with the force that sustains you. So in a way, in that great inquiry, there is, in a way, this very much this experience, I would say, of connection. And that's why I would say that over time, the meditation, actually, although it seems kind of a bit strange, we're sitting here watching the breath, and it seems a very self-referential activity. But by looking into the changing nature, by knowing the suffering, Stephen will talk more about this, by experiencing that conditionality, actually we see, we open up ourselves to the world, to the web of life. And I think this is what we're doing when we meditate. So that's what I wanted to say today. So there is one thing I wanted to say also is I've written up all the personal interviews. We do it in a little different way than Tovana does it generally. We're going to be, it's a new method. I mean, that's what we do generally. We're going to put all the days, all the slots, not one by one. And you just each have one slot. And it's for you to decide, do I want to be early? Do I want to be late? There is a slot for everybody, so don't worry, you don't have to rush. Nobody is going to take your place. But if there is a time you prefer, just put your name. So if everybody wants to sign all the slots tonight, this is fine by me. I have no problem with it. If it builds up over the day, fine. But if the slots are not filled tomorrow, then this is problematic. Because they have to, because there is only one slot for one person. So make sure that they're filled each day, but just by one person. We can't do two interview for one person. If you need more interview, you can let us know, and then we'll see you at another time. Is it kind of relatively clear? But anyway, you'll see it when you see the thing. So some slots are with Stephen, some with me, and they will be in the two rooms which are at the end of these blocks where there is a blue railing. But I think over day we kind of will all get together how to do it. And they for 15 minutes each one fine. So that's what I wanted to say. Are there any questions or comments? We just have a little time before the walking. If there is no question or comments, you'll have more time for question and comment. The first evening is a little maybe early to think of something. So now there is a walking meditation, and then we'll meet back here in 45 minutes for the final sitting from 8:30 till 9 o'clock. Thank you.